Registration is now open for Meet Me at the Margin, a month-long virtual conference for queer people who want to reclaim and restore their innate capacity for ambiguity, paradox, and liminality. Through a series of eight workshops facilitated by some of today's most marginal thinkers, participants will explore queerness through the lenses of tarot, astrology, narrative therapy, eco-mythology, archetype art, and more. Facilitators include Charlie Claire Burgess, Amy DeGennaro, Edgar Fabian Frias, Nick Kepley, Jonathan Coe, Elias Lallier, Sophie Strand, Jason Perez, and Chanti Tankaranto Perez. The conference kicks off June 4th with sessions held every Sunday and Wednesday evening through June 18th. Discounted rates are available for students ages 18 to 22, as well as for members of the trans and drag communities. Visit manofthecards.com/meetmeatthemargin to register, and we'll see you at the margin next month. Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Today's guest is Eli Lallier, PhD. Eli is the gender doula, offering full spectrum support to folks who are transitioning, questioning, or exploring their gender. Due to the unique nature of every gender journey, Eli pulls from his many experiences, a working class background in retail, 10 years of academic research on trans healthcare in the US, 5 years of tarot reading for others, and much more, to support clients holistically. He also uses his broad training to create workshops, classes, and resources to help gender expansive folks thrive. He lives in Los Angeles with his partner, three cats, a dog, and four snakes. And speaking of the snakes, Eli will be leading a very special workshop on exploring gender using snake medicine as part of the Meet Me at the Margin virtual queer conference, which kicks off June 4th and runs through June 28th. And if you're interested in more information about that conference, you can visit manofthecards.com/meetmeatthemargin. All right, enjoy this wonderful conversation that I was privileged to have with Eli Lallier, the gender doula. So thank you so much for being here. All of your work is just very fascinating. I'm excited to speak with you today and introduce you to anyone that's not familiar with your work, but it's, you know, all of your writing and your ritual work and just everything I think is really, really fascinating. So I read on your blog that this work of being a gender doula was inspired a little bit by a podcast with Erica Livingston, who you say was talking about how there needs to be a doula for every threshold of life, which I thought was really powerful. So will you kind of explain, first of all, just what a doula is, and then what a gender doula is, and then what your work specifically entails in that capacity?
Sure. So I think of doula work in a variety of ways, but I think one of the easiest ways to explain it is that, like, we wouldn't need doulas if community was more robust, right? So, like, oftentimes the space a doula is taking is space that might have been normally, like, filled by, like, an auntie or, like, you know, other community members, like someone who's there to really support you and who has a lot of resources and can, like, really come in and fill in this space that is often just, like, very, very empty in our culture. And what that means in the birth world is that oftentimes doulas really function in this way that is both within the medical realm and also outside of the medical realm. They can kind of traverse both. Mm-hmm. So a doula can be in the room with you while you're, you know, having a child, and they can talk to a doctor, they can talk to a nurse, but they're not a doctor or a nurse, and they're not bound to the same sort of, like, practice models as doctors and nurses. So that doula can also then be in your home and, like, cooking you soup afterwards while you're recovering, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really magical space to occupy. And part of the reason why I chose doula as the framework for the work that I do, as opposed to other things, because trans folks have helped other trans people transition for like ever, mm-hmm. and often under many different names that include things like companion or coach. And I really felt like doula was the most apt way to describe what I do, because it is that like both medical and not medical thing. It's spiritual, but also practical. You know, it sort of fills in all those gaps of, if you were sort of like, oh, I wish I'd had XYZ thing when I was transitioning, those are the things that I offer typically, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it gives me a chance to function in many different ways and to meet people where they're at and to make things very, very tailored, because what I'm offering is support. And what support looks like can change just dramatically depending on the person or the situation or the need.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to kind of explore your story that you share in your bio on your website. And the very first sentence in that bio, you say, I was in my early 20s before I learned from a library book that trans was something that one could be. And it's interesting to read that, because I feel like there's been an ongoing theme this season on the podcast of a lot of guests talking about discovering their queerness through the act of reading, which I love because I love to read. But I will say, unfortunately, I wish it had been this way, but I don't necessarily feel like I discovered that about myself through my reading, just because I just wasn't finding those sources. But those sources are so much more kind of out there now, and we're kind of fighting to keep them that way, you know. But certainly I love the idea that the act of reading is kind of bringing people, you know, to that. So I wondered if you would kind of open up that story a little bit about that discovery and how that was for you.
Sure. I think when I was in my early 20s, I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I was living in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is actually where I was born. But I grew up in Southwest Missouri. So I'd moved back to Tulsa with a friend. And I don't remember what set me off on that journey. But I think that I discovered that people could be intersex, and I hadn't known that either. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get more information on it. And this is probably back in like 2009 or so, maybe 2008. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know, trying to figure this out, wasn't sure how to research it. And I went to the library and I found this book by Ricky Wilchins called Queer Theory, Gender Theory. And I never read anything like that before in my life. Mm-hmm. And I just like opened it up and started reading it like in the aisle of the library. And it was just like mind blowing. I mean, I was like, what? You know, like, yeah. You're telling me what? And like, it was a very transformational book. And it took me my whole 20s to get from that moment to like, I want to start hormones. But that was really like when I began that journey of gender exploration.
I mean, this is why we need libraries, right? So we can just go down aisles and discover these things. I'm curious if you also have found any influence or any inspiration through like fictional work at all. Like, I love sci-fi. I'm just kind of curious, like, what other reading you've done, if there are any other threads that you found along the way.
I mean, there's all kinds of fictional work that I've loved, but I would say where fiction has had the most profound impact on my gender exploration was actually writing it rather than reading it. Mm-hmm. So for many years, I wanted to be a writer and I really pursued that. And then I sort of realized that none of the professional avenues for that worked for me. Like, they just didn't work for me and what I wanted in life. And so I sort of like gave it all up and was like, ah, fuck writing forever. But then a few years after that, I sort of rediscovered like fandom and fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And I went through this phase that lasted for a couple of years where I was just constantly writing fan fiction. I mean, just reams of it, hundreds of thousands of words. And like recently, I mean, it's been a couple of years ago, I went back and reread some of those stories. And I was like, oh my God, like this was me grappling with my gender. Like all this fan fiction was me grappling with like masculinity and gender and what it meant and what it meant to be a trans man and things like that. And it was just like, I was really, really working through that. But at the time I just felt like, oh, this is so much fun. I'm writing fan fiction, people like it. It was only in hindsight that I realized how much of that was me working through my gender.
Yeah, yeah. Do you mind if I ask you what masculinity means to you?
That's a really complicated question.
Yeah, yeah.
I think to answer that, I have to go back to kind of like how I engage with masculinity through my transition. So once I started testosterone, so, well, I'll go back even a little further. I identified as non-binary for several years and went by they, them pronouns. And at the time I was like, oh, I'm not going to pursue surgery or hormones. And what was true for me, and of course, this is only for me, I'm not saying this is true for anyone else in that identity realm, but what was true for me is that that choice was based on a feeling of not being worthy, or like, this is not accessible to me. Like I can't do that. So it was like very much like sort of a self-esteem situation. So when I started taking testosterone, I was very, very scared of it. But as I started to feel changes in my body, it was very undeniable how much joy and how much pleasure that was bringing to me in this way that I'd never experienced before. So then I started, you know, taking more testosterone, obviously a proper dose, not like, not just randomly taking more, but with my doctor, taking more testosterone and seeing those changes come in faster. And then, you know, my body started to masculinize and I started to realize that the way that people were perceiving me was going to shift. And so I realized that I had this opportunity to create a masculinity that was in line with my values. And part of the reason I had that level of insight is because, first of all, I was 29. I wasn't young, like a, you know, teenager. But second of all, I was in, during that time, I was getting my degree in gender studies and LGBT studies from UCLA. So I was sort of like steeped in this gender theory and in questions of masculinity and the violence of masculinity. And I was like, okay, I don't want to be violent. I don't want to hurt anyone. I've been harmed deeply by masculinity as a child. And so how am I going to show up in the world in a way that is still in line with my values, which is very much informs how I help people with gender exploration now as a gender doula. But it was really about discovering a masculinity that used the traits that I already possessed and felt good about as my starting point, instead of traits that other people said I should embody as a masculine person.
What I like about what you just shared is that it feels like you're kind of pointing to having the ability to build it the way that you kind of want it. But I am wondering like what it was like to balance that with societal views on it. And also the fact that you were studying it, like you said, so deeply, and then also going through this very personal transition, that must have, I don't know, that just must have really put such a spotlight on a lot of components of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that one thing that I really had to do was reckon with detaching myself from the cultural narrative of what masculinity was, because there was such a strong cultural narrative, especially when I grew up, my family was conservative Christian. My father was extremely abusive and a narcissist. And so like there was this masculinity that I was raised with that was very toxic, very insecure, very misogynistic. And actually for the part of my gender exploration that was my 20s, when I was really just struggling, part of the reason I struggled so hard is because my question was, did I just internalize so much misogyny that I can't stand to be a woman anymore? Is that what's happening to me? You know, and I really had to engage with that, which is actually the reason I pursued gender studies as an academic discipline, because I am a nerd. And I was like, oh, if I need to find answers, the way I seek that is through the academy. And, you know, things have changed since then, like there's a lot more to it for me now. But at the time, that was really what I saw as the avenue. So as I was sort of looking at this, I was looking at other trans people. I was looking at queerness. I was looking at what I didn't want to be, but I was also looking at what do I want to be? What models of masculinity do work for me? And I found that like sometimes separating from human models and looking more to models found in nature was really helpful. So for example, looking to like, what does it mean for a sequoia tree to be like an ecosystem? You know, what does it mean for that organism to take up space? What does it mean for the root system to exist as it does? Like, and how is that masculinity? You know, and then also I did this thing that I still use with clients a lot, which is like sort of flipping the script. So picking a trait that I loved about myself that was considered feminine and looking at that trait and being like, how is this masculine? Mm-hmm. Right. So something like being a very nurturing person, this is considered a feminine trait in our current culture.
Right.
So I'd be like, okay, but what does it mean to be nurturing in a masculine way or as a masculine being? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that energy come through? And it helps me to sort of crack open my perceptions around what masculinity was, which then allowed me to create sort of a bespoke masculinity that was like mine, you know,
yeah.
And wasn't sort of relying on cultural narratives for its base.
Yeah. And what about tarot? When did that come in? And was that part of your exploration of all of this?
Yeah, definitely. Tarot for me came in, I would say, 2 years after I started hormones, I think. It started as me trying, I was actually reflecting on this just yesterday because I was writing just a personal essay about Rachel Pollack passing and like what she meant to me. And I was reflecting on how I came to tarot, which was really an act of desperation as I was starting my PhD and realizing that I had been really mistreating my body in order to accomplish academic feats and other things, and that I was no longer going to be able to continue putting myself through that. And part of what that process was learning how to reach towards spirituality in a way that was not the organized religion of my youth, mm-hmm. but that was specific to me. And tarot was a big part of that. So as I was engaging with tarot, of course, one of the first things that many of us find is like, these cards are gendered in a way that does not make sense at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was lucky enough to have tarot teachers who at least acknowledged that and were like, oh, like this is like, you know, you'll see that these cards represent masculinity or femininity, but there's more to it than that. But it took me a while to sort of figure out what my actual feelings about that were. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually going to be teaching a class on it with C. Grape Apothecary in the fall. So
amazing.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
But I have like a whole different structure of how I approach sort of the gendered cards in the tarot that's sort of based on that process of exploration.
Amazing. So in another blog post where you're talking about gender rituals, and while I'm speaking about this, if you haven't picked up on this already, anyone that's listening definitely should go check out your blog because every single post is just really rich and amazing. But I saw a quote from Jules Gill Peterson's essay, My Undead Name, which I have not read, but which now I really want to read. But I would love to read that quote now and have you kind of dance a little bit with it for our listeners, if that's okay with
sure,
you.
Sure.
Okay. So it reads, "The demand placed on trans people for consistency and commitment to names and pronouns has the opposite of its intended effect in the outcome. Would-be allies think they are showing that they take trans people's identity seriously by intensely conforming to contemporary conventions. But what they're really saying is, I need you to be legible, clear, and easy for me to understand. I need your gender to make me comfortable," end quote. And this idea of uncomfortableness has really been on my mind lately. A lot of my writing and work as of late is focused on the margin and sort of like Gloria Anzaldúa's, you know, La Pantla, you know, and this kind of very liminal, unknowable, untranslatable thing that I think it is to be queer, you know? And so I really appreciate this quote for pointing to that, but I would love to hear you kind of open it up a little bit.
Definitely. I mean, I really appreciate this quote too. And I think it's funny because it makes me feel like there's this tension between what I guess I would name the DEI approach to, so the diversity, equity, and inclusion approach to gender, mm-hmm. and like the actual like wildness, I guess, of queerness and transness, mm-hmm. And how they, it's funny because I think our culture has privileged the DEI approach because it's A, easy, B, because it's what people are used to, right? But I think most importantly, because it gives clear expectations You know, like if you think about how corporate culture works, it's like, okay, here's our marks. This is what we need to hit. We're going to have like a little rubric, right? And that's definitely this like approach of like, oh, if you want to be a good ally, everybody should put their pronouns in their email. And everyone should like, you know, be so like hyper aware of their languaging and stuff like that. When in actuality, the actual way to, I think, honor people's genders or to respect them or to like move with them and allow for the fluidity is to engage more fully with the wildness of queerness and transness and understand that like when you open yourself up to the vast realm of possibility of gender exploration and presentation and identity and all these other facets, it's better for everyone. And it's much better for everyone than the DEI approach, right? Because I know endless people who have their pronouns in their email signature and cannot use a they, them to save their life, you know? And then I know lots of people who don't have their pronouns in their signature, but actually show up for trans people, you know, and are willing to like hold space for identities to shift and change over time and not to like try to constrain people into any sort of box, you know. And I think that that is something that benefits everyone, because no one is comfortable in a like a box of a label. No one's fully comfortable in that way, right? Like there's no person who identifies as a woman, regardless if she was assigned female at birth, who is like every single thing associated with this label fits me exactly, right? Like she doesn't exist, right? And that goes for all labels. Right. And so when we open it up and we allow for there to be sort of the endless variation of humanity, then everyone benefits from that. And that is also relative to this idea of like sort of religiously trying to use names and pronouns, because even though it's obviously good to honor someone's name and pronouns, and I'm not saying that that's not it, but like people use that as a proxy for like, and now I am unassailable as a quote unquote good person. Instead of allowing themselves to really understand or crack open to the fullness of what it means to explore gender and to explore sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. Because like my journey with all of that was really, you know, it was through Alok Vaidmenon that I like first started to kind of question and think about all of this. And it really came down to just like, what does it even mean? What does it mean to be a man or a woman? Like, what are the words he, she mean even, you know, like, and I think that, that's really the truth, like under, for all of us, like, we're, you know, that we're all in some kind of transitional state always, you know, like, but we want to be very fixed, you know, and then when you get confronted by change, you know, which is something I'm really thinking about a lot right now too, it makes you have to change, you know, because we're in relationship. So like, if I know you and I'm in a relationship with you and you're changing, then I'm going to have to either change too, or I'm going to have to leave you, you know, leave the relationship. So I think that, like you're saying, I think having these definitive terms or words, it's like, it feels safer because it's just like, okay, great. So I just say this word, and then we get to stay in our boxes and, you know, we can just move on instead of having to grapple with the much more complex reality of like what it is to be alive, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. I totally agree.
So, yeah. So we talked a little bit about tarot, but now what I want to hear more about how you work with gender, with the tarot. And I'm curious now that we're talking about fixity, something that I'm kind of always grappling with tarot and archetype is the fixedness of like archetype and the way the cards can get really fixed and the different ways that you can approach working with the cards. You know, like for some people, you can kind of say Five of Cups and it can have this kind of Rolodex, you know, meaning kind of, you know, or for some people, it's very different, you know? And so I'm wondering how this idea of keeping things a little bit more transitional comes into play for you with tarot.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, there's lots of ways that I work with this with tarot. So I've been reading tarot for, I think, 6 years, maybe. Time is weird, but who knows?
Yeah.
But I've been reading tarot for some amount of time that is more than 5 years. And I think that, you know, at first it was just a real struggle to try and just remember everything.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, there's so much here. But once you sort of get over that hump, working with the cards themselves and like sort of cultivating my own relationship to them has taken a variety of different, paths. And one of the things that's been really helpful to me is, first of all, realizing that the tarot readings that I gave when I was a baby tarot reader and like looking up everything in the book and all of that were actually really good. They were great readings. And like, I've had people come back to me and be like, oh, you read my cards like 6 years ago. And like everything that you said was so profound. And like, it's been such, and I was like, what? Like I was 6 years ago, I was absolutely like looking everything up in the book and I did not have any sort of like internal relationship with the cards. And yet, and so like that really has helped me because it's made me realize that the person that you are drawn to go to read your cards is the person who's holding the medicine that you need to hear. Mm. And even if that means they're holding it in a book in their hand, right? Like that, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes, like I'll even have clients who come to me and they're like, oh, a friend of mine pulled a card. It was this card. What do you think it means? And I'm like, what did they tell you it meant?
Yeah.
You know, like, let's start there. Right. And they're like, oh, well, they just read out of a book. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Like what came up, you know, because even if you're reading a book, there may be some things that do or don't resonate in that moment. And that's also good information. Right. Mm-hmm. So realizing that has been helpful for me because A, it keeps me humble. Mm-hmm. But B, it also allows me to then get more insight on the cards. Like, for example, the deck that I do my morning practice with is not the deck that I read for anyone else ever. And when I do my morning practice, I read the guidebook from that deck because I really like the guidebook. And it gives me fresh, beautiful insights on the cards that are poetically written. And that also helps me sort of like, because you know, the way poetry is and the economy of words, like it just kind of opens you up with like one little phrase, you know? Mm-hmm. So I love that. And then the other thing is just like really sitting with feeling into the different energies. So recently, I had a whole new set of revelations about the devil, which if you're doing the thing where you break the major arcana into the three lines, mm-hmm. the final line is like the devil through the world. And I'd always had really strong feelings about the tower through the sun, mm-hmm. But kind of like focused on that part of the line. Mm-hmm. And then recently, through a variety of life events and contemplation and practice and whatever, I just like had this huge new realization about the devil. And I think that working with the cards a lot allows for those moments to happen where it's like, you can interpret a card in one way over and over and over again. And then you work with it or like, so you go through something or you're talking to someone or it hits in a certain part of a reading and you're like, oh my God, like there's a whole dimension to this that I haven't explored yet. Mm-hmm. And letting yourself be open to that instead of thinking like, okay, I know what these cards mean. I have it all down. You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm realizing in this moment, like for a while now, I've had, you know, kind of mixed, complicated feelings about any kind of prescriptive description of like what a card means, quote unquote. And definitely some sources are more adamant about like, this is definitively what it means than others are. But just now, as you were speaking, I was realizing that it also really matters how I'm approaching that source, you know, like if I'm going to that source, acting like it's going to tell me what this person thinks the card means or whatever, versus if I'm just kind of like reading it more like inspirationally or like poetry or just like a gesture, you know, like you're saying, you know, just reading this guidebook because it's fun to just like kind of muse on that card in a different way that you wouldn't maybe think of yourself, you know? So like holding it a little bit looser in that way can be as much my responsibility as the person that's writing the source, you know?
Yeah.
And that reminds me too of, I had Ari Felix on recently, who is an astrologer, and they were using binary terminology, but every time they would do it, they would say, just to play with that for a second, you know? And I really loved that. Like, I really loved this idea that you can just like opt in, just tap into the binary for a second and like, you know, just like play with it. And like, yeah, because for a while it's felt like, it's so hard to get out of it that I think for a long time I had to like fight with everything I had to like kind of get myself unhooked from that. But now that I feel, you know, semi unhooked, like now it's kind of nice to be like, oh, maybe I can kind of play with it now because it is there. I mean, like in that the world does use it, you know, like it does have meaning because we give it meaning, and it does have reality because it is in the world. And so playing with it rather than just trying to sort of deny it is an interesting way of going about it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think like also to what you're saying, like as far as like the binary, it's like we've all been indoctrinated with this from, you know, since day one, right? And so it's great to break out of it. It's great to then play with it. It's great to reform. Like if you think about if you broke out of the binary and it left a bunch of debris on the floor, and then you took that debris and you made it into a new sculpture, and it had like pieces of that, but it was something entirely different, right? Like that's also a fun way to engage with these cards and with most archetypes and these various things that we've used to try to organize our understanding of the world and our experience in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think also though that like looking at all the different ways that queer and trans people have approached, you know, the tarot, you know, there's all these beautiful decks. The main deck that I read with is Slow Holler, and it has this gorgeous guidebook, you know, it's very queer, very trans. And like, you know, just reading, like, what was it that they had to say? They called the High Priestess the Oracle. Like, what was it that they had to say about the Oracle? And like, how did they try to like work with that card? Like, why did they change the Empress to Kindred? And what does that mean? And what were they looking at, you know? And then like, what parts of that resonate with me? Mm-hmm. And, but then also always recognizing that when you're reading for a human, what parts of this card are resonating with this person? What message are their guides or ancestors or transcestors trying to give you for them, right? Because it may not be the way that you read that card for yourself or for another person.
Right.
You know?
Which can be the hard part, you know, or the more complicated, complex, you know, kind of part. You write really beautifully about the 7 and 8 of cups on your blog. And I wondered if you would kind of share a little bit about those thoughts.
Sure. Yeah. I feel like eventually I'm going to have like a cups as gender exploration course. Like I was like bubbling on the back burner and have been for years.
Mm-hmm.
And where it started with me is the 8 of cups, which to me is like the transest card of the tarot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain that one and use it as my entry point to the 7, because I think that that's an easier way to explain it. The 8 of cups for me represents a time where you have put tremendous investment into something. And you've traveled with it for a long time and you've worked really hard on it. And now in order to keep going, you have to let it go and leave it and go on a new path. And not only do you have to go on a new path, but you have to go on a path that you cannot see the end of. Like you can't see around the bend. Pretty soon it's going to bend and you can't see past that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you have no clue where it's taking you, and you have to like leave behind all this stuff that you put so much effort into and go in an unburdened but terrified way toward the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is like very trans vibes, you know. Like, God, I've worked so hard to be a woman and now I just have to leave that all behind.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like and it's also very frightening, you know, because of the work I do. I talk to people at every different stage of transition, but like I do talk to a larger concentration of people who are in early stages or who are just starting to come into an awareness of a trans identity, or just starting to be like, maybe I want to try hormones and things like that. And so really like holding people at that threshold moment feels very like 8 of cups work. And it feels like that is sort of not the beginning, but like a really important piece of the journey. So that brings me to the 7 of cups, which I hear a lot of people sort of describing as like, you know, daydreaming or illusion, like these really like trite things. Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with that at all. To me, the dreaming that's happening in the 7 of cups is the dreaming that allows you to create space for the potential of a new future. And so when you're in that dreaming space of the 7 of cups and you're seeing all these different options, you're probably seeing a bunch of options that are not going to look exactly like the reality of where you're going, right? Mm. But seeing them and seeing the possibility of them is the thing that gives you the spark of maybe it's worth it to leave these eight cups behind. Maybe it's worth it to go on that path and to go into the unknown and to be terrified, like, because I had this beautiful dream. And if I could even accomplish one bit of that, it would be worth it. So mm-hmm. maybe it's worth it to give all this up, right? Mm-hmm. And those to me are two really integral parts of transition.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that so much. So let's transition now into talking about snake medicine, which is something that when you reached out, you mentioned that it's something kind of on the newer side that you're starting to offer. And yeah, I would just love to hear you kind of talk about that and what that is.
Yeah, so snake medicine is an idea that came to me as I was tending to my snake. So I have two snakes. I have a gray banded king snake named Icky, which is short for Ichabod, and a ball python named Nugget. And they're very cute. But I got both of these snakes, and I hadn't realized before then what the shed cycle actually was. Like, to me, it was like, oh, I know that snakes shed, you know, and that's kind of the extent of my knowledge. Like, the skin comes off, right? Mm-hmm. But by having these two snakes and sort of working with them through multiple sheds, I realized that this is actually a multi-part process. And in that multi-part process, there are endless analogs to, like, personal transformation. And I see that echoed through my life and then reflected through my snakes' experiences. And then as I was sort of, like, watching this and taking this in and working with it, I also read that snakes were a symbol of gender fluidity in sort of, like, Celtic tradition, because you can't look at a snake and sort of know the sex. Uh-huh. And also because they've sort of, like, occupied this space of, like, spiritual importance, and, like, which is also true for trans people and people who have exhibited gender fluidity. And so snakes have this really strong connection to transness or to gender fluidity or ambiguity. And so those sort of different aspects came together and created this thing that I call snake medicine, which started as me just being like, hey guys, I've been having some wacky thoughts, and then, like, turned into, like, a class.
Yeah.
So I did the first version of snake medicine last fall, and it's a 12-week long class with 6 modules. So it's 2 weeks for each module because it's heavy. It's heavy work. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really exciting. So basically, you start from this idea of the 4 stages of shedding. The first one is what I call the retreat. So in this stage, the snake will find a safe space. And I will know that they are beginning this cycle because they won't be coming out anymore. They'll be hiding. Mm-hmm. In the sort of wild, this would also be like the snake would be finding a place where they could be reasonably safe, because it's very vulnerable to go into shed. Mm-hmm. And then I also sort of tie that to in the idea of an underworld journey, like descending into the underworld. The second phase is called going blue, which is not a name that I made up. It's, like, generally what this phase is known as in herpetology community, like, amateurs, right? I'm sure there's a scientific name for it. But it's called going blue because basically there's a layer of oil that comes and separates the skin, old skin, and allows the new skin to start, you know, coming through. Mm. And when they're in that phase, they kind of look like zombies. Like, their eyes go, like, milky, and their whole body is sort of, like, dull looking. And during this phase, they're, like, really not coming out of their hiding. You know, they don't want to be messed with. They don't want to eat, although king snakes always want to eat. So, but most snakes don't want to eat during this time. After going blue, one of the things that's really interesting is that they don't just immediately shed, right? Like, after they go blue, they actually go clear again. So their skin may look a little dull, but they mostly look normal, but they're still hiding, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point in that phase, they have to decide, okay, I'm going to come out of my hiding place. Mm-hmm. And that's what allows them to then shed the old skin and come out fresh. So even just saying that, usually people start to make the connections. They're like, yeah. Oh, I've been blue before. You know? But we go very, very deep on each of those phases. And I connect the whole thing to an underworld journey. And it's a really like intense exploration of grief and change and how we move through those energies.
Yeah. So this is specifically for people who are kind of going through the transitional process themselves, or...
It's for anyone, actually. Snake medicine is really open to anyone. It kind of embodies my belief that, like, people, if people learn from trans people, like, everyone could benefit from that, you know? Like,
right.
It's not just about gender, although right. It could be about gender, right? Like, mm-hmm. It can definitely be about that. I think trans people go through many shed cycles. mm-hmm. But I think we all also go through many shed cycles. And, like, that's one thing that came up in the class is that folks were like, when I look at my grief, like, it's too much. Like, how am I supposed to deal with all this? How can all this be shed? And one of the important points is there are many sheds. You mm-hmm. only have to process what you can process today. If your grief is an ocean, just take a little cup of your hands, you know, and process that part. Mm-hmm. Because there will be more sheds and there will be more opportunities. And this is a cycle that you'll be going through for the rest of your life. So yeah. Like, learning how to have the tools for that process instead of trying to like get it all over with and move on.
Right. Yeah. And as you were explaining that process, which I did not know, but the nerd in me loved, I'm going to like literally go YouTube snakes after this. that's really interesting. But when you were talking about the snake going to go into hiding and find like a safe space, that also kind of made me think back to Eight of Cups, because a lot of times people say that the Eight of Cups comes like before the Hermit. And so this idea of like, okay, I'm ready to leave this behind. And now I'm going to go like find this place, this safe space to go through this process. You know, I wonder what, advice you might give. I feel like a lot of people that are, you know, really going through anything, but, you know, I'll speak specifically to sort of people going through gender explorations or like queer exploration, want to know about ritual work, like specific ritual work that they can do to kind of help them through this process. And I'm wondering what advice you might give to someone that's maybe just at the start of this, you know, journey and wanting to kind of have something to support them or some kind of ritual to do or something like that. I don't know if you have any personal stories of things that you did or anything that you work with clients on that you would want to share or anything about that.
Yeah, I think that we benefit so much from ritual and from incorporating it. And I actually am hoping to put together, like, I don't know, probably a little zine or something, because my gender rituals blog has been probably by far the most popular thing I've ever put on my blog. And I think people are really hungry for it. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different ways that I use this with clients and that I recommend using ritual. And I feel like, you know, I want to tell people about it. So thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I often use with people is rituals around starting hormones. And so what that looks like depends on the person and what their needs are, of course, but often incorporates some form of ritualizing taking your hormones or using your hormones, especially at the beginning. And this works really well for everybody, but I think is especially helpful when folks have medical anxiety or anxiety about the hormones. So one form of ritual that I use with people, like let's say someone is relatively sure that they want hormones, or at least like is sure enough that they went to the doctor and got a prescription, right? Mm-hmm. But they're scared to take them, right? This happens all the time. It's totally normal. I was exactly the same. So one way to work with this is to take whatever form the medication is, whether that's like gel or patches or pills or injection, whatever, and hold it in your hand and just let yourself feel it. And if it feels okay to ask your body, you know, I want to introduce this new substance. Are you ready for this today? And if you get a no, put it back on the shelf and go about your day and wait and see what changes over time. Oftentimes, after a certain amount of doing this every day, people will either start to get a more neutral feeling or they'll eventually start to get a yes. And so that can help overcome some of that initial trepidation.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is with injections. A lot of folks have anxiety around injections. And so creating a whole ritual around your injection and what that looks like, again, varies, but it can be lighting candle. You can pull cards. You know, you can have like a moment where you're calling in your transcestors or the elements, whatever feels right to you, connecting to an animal or a plant friend. It helps your body relax and know what's going on and that you're safe. And then that in turn helps you to perform the injection with less anxiety. So that would be like some hormone rituals. Other rituals, I've done a name and pronoun release ritual. I've done versions of this that are private, but also I did one on the beach last year with cuties in Los Angeles, which was amazing. I've done like Zoom versions. And so that's a really, and you know, it takes a long time to describe these rituals, but it's a lovely ritual. And I think there's lots of ways to do it. I also do a lot of rituals with folks around surgery. So the idea of like whatever part of your body that's going to be modified, bringing up all of the things that you're grateful for about that part of your body, if you can, but if not that, then about the life you've lived with that part of your body. Mm-hmm. So what are the good things that you've experienced with that part of your body? And then releasing it with love and bringing your body in as an ally for recovery and moving forward in this kind of like consensual, supported way with like, okay, we're getting ready to go through a big change and I want you to be my ally in this to your body. So again, these can take lots of forms and a lot of it depends on whether or not people are spiritual or if they're just doing this as more of like a energetic type ritual, but I do think it's a very overlooked and very powerful part of transition.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you for all of those. So the last question that I want to ask you is something that I've been asking all my guests for a little while now, which is, I'm wondering what you are in search of right now in your life.
I think right now I'm really in search of learning how to be in community. And not just as an individual, but in like this more existential or group question, because with things that are going on right now politically in this country, with the current attack on trans people, I hear so many people talking about how scared they are, which I get 100%. It's a very scary time to be trans. And also as a person who studied transness for many years academically, I have like this long view of transness that I think is really different from a lot of people, because we've been in this state many times before. Every 30 to 50 years, there's like a moral panic about trans people. And every other time this has happened, we have had almost nothing. Like we've had no political power, no sort of like cultural cachet, very little sort of like community building capacity, right? And so, you know, like in the mid-century of the 1900s, it was like people were sending each other zines in the mail, and then sometimes those zines would be caught, and then those people would be like charged with like sending lewd material. So even just trying to like send community information out could end up with you being charged with a crime, right? Like how different is that from right now? You know, like we have doctors and lawyers and politicians, people who, you know, in the past were only ever trying to harm us. Now we have trans people in those positions who are actually working really hard to, you know, help us and keep us safe. So I think like my view of it is as a community, if we can come together and we can move with each other in what I've heard Adrienne Marie Brown call principled struggle, we can actually do so much. Like we're actually unstoppable in my opinion. And we get really distracted with sort of infighting and this sort of internalized transphobia and the way that the people around us characterize us. And unfortunately, those distractions keep us from being able to fully embody our power. So I've been thinking a lot about that and about how to create community in ways that do engage in principled struggle, but also hold all of us in love and make sure that no one's treated like they're disposable and allow for us to access the fullness of our power. And it's a really intense question, but that's what I'm currently in search of.
Yeah, that's,
I mean, that's the power of history, I think, you know, like that. I mean, that's been my experience too with like, even with tarot, you know, like learning the actual history of tarot, you're like, oh, there is precedent for other ways or other decks, or, you know, there's a whole chunk where we have no idea what happened, you know, like, so that's where I think history can be really helpful. Like you're saying, just like knowing that there's precedent for this. And then like, I mean, that's very encouraging what you're pointing to. And it's true. It's easy to feel completely just defeated, but like there has been actually a lot of progress. And yeah, I appreciate that a lot. So I want to let people know how they can find you and work with you, because I know they're going to want to after this. So yeah, just share, you know, and I think you might've mentioned that you have something coming up at the end of May. So if you want to talk about that, but just anything you want to share with people.
Yeah, definitely. Right now I'm currently only using Instagram, I think, in terms of social media. So I'm The Gender Doula on Instagram. My website is thegenderdoula.com. The best way to keep in touch with me always is to be signed up on my mailing list. People who are on my mailing list get an exclusive, which I call Ask the Gender Doula. So every month you can send questions. I answer them, a little advice column. So that's really fun. And also people on my mailing list get discounts on classes and workshops and first access to everything. So I highly recommend signing up for the mailing list. I really love how mailing lists are like consensual content. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just plugging that deeply. But for upcoming stuff, I have, I'm hoping to do my first iteration of my gender exploration class, which will be called Re-envisioning Gender. And that should be coming up hopefully at the end of May. And I'm planning for that to be a 4-week class. There will be payment plans and scholarships available. And so keep an eye out for that. I have the gender expansive tarot workshop with Sea Grape Apothecary coming up in September. I'll do another round of snake medicine, probably also in September. And I do currently have space in my books for one-on-one clients, as well as other gender doulas that I am in contact with. If I am not the right gender doula for you, but you're still looking for one, I can help with that as well.
Amazing. Well, Eli, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time for this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's BIRDGERHL_. And you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.